Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Great Creators early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. If you like this episode, will you do me a favor and follow The Great Creators in your podcast app? It's usually a button right at the top that says follow. It's free, and it means you'll never miss a new episode. And thanks. Hey, it's Guy here, and before we start the show, I want to let you know about one of my other podcasts. It's called How I Built This, where I talk to the founders behind some of the world's biggest and most innovative brands, including the story of how Michael Kors went from small-time designer into building one of the world's biggest fashion brands. So check out How I Built This, where you'll find this story and hundreds more like it. Think of it like the most inspiring business class ever, only for free. Find How I Built This wherever you listen to podcasts. Okay, on to the show. From Built It Productions, it's The Great Creators. Conversations about creativity with some of the most celebrated actors, musicians, and performers of our time. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, Ellie Goulding on finding her voice after a whirlwind ascent to the top of the pop charts.
I kind of passed out. I had a panic attack. I went to hospital. This woman told me to blow into a paper bag. There was a pain down my entire left arm, and my heart was pounding. And I really thought, this is it. I was going to be gone.
Ellie Goulding has had 35 different songs chart in the United Kingdom, and she's only 36 years old. That's the most of any female solo artist in UK history. Her rise to fame was meteoric. Within a couple of years of releasing her first album, Lights, in 2010, Ellie went from singing songs alone in her bedroom to playing Coachella, opening for Katy Perry, and even singing at Prince William and Kate Middleton's wedding reception. In this episode of The Great Creators, you'll hear how listening to artists like Bjork and Stevie Nicks gave Ellie the courage to embrace her own distinct voice. We talk about how Ellie collaborates with artists like Ryan Tedder and Calvin Harris, and how her songwriting process changed after having her first child. And you'll hear why Ellie calls her newest album, Higher Than Heaven, her least personal record yet, and how that's made her a better songwriter. That's all coming up after this quick break.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Ellie Goulding was born in the small village of Lionshall in Herefordshire, England. Before she was in the spotlight, Ellie was a really shy kid and was raised by her mother in a tiny council estate.
I was 5 years old when my parents split up, and I remember the day that my dad left. It's always like one of my first memories. And, you know, that's not great for that to be one of your first memories, but I remember just throwing a cushion at him or something, and I remember being mad and not really understanding what was going on. And I still to this day don't really know entirely what happened between them, but he walked out and then didn't see him for a long time. And I remember being like, how do I act as a like 6 or 7 year old, being like, how do I act in front of him in the street if I see him? You know, because we lived in a small town. Yeah. I remember thinking that as a small child. And then my mom met this other guy, not the greatest person. I think she can acknowledge that. And then she had a child with this guy. So there was three of us, and then my half sister, and then we moved out to the countryside, which at the time, you know, I didn't want to do. I loved where I was, and we grew up in this tiny, tiny house, and then we moved out to the country because that's where her partner lived.
Yeah.
And then I started school there, and you know what? It was such a blessing in disguise moving to the country. I didn't know it at the time, but you know that would kind of become my ultimate savior. Kind of sounds extreme, but it was like thank God for nature and having. I didn't want to be at home that much, so thank God for being out. You know, running around fields, walking for miles so that I'd get lost. And also just having the friends I had there. We were all from similar backgrounds. It wasn't abnormal to come from a dysfunctional family. It wasn't strange to come from divorced parents, you know. So it was we had that in common.
Tell me, I read something that you said that as a kid you felt different to everyone else. That you felt, you know, sort of like an outsider. What do you remember about feeling that way, and why?
I think I remember sharing my thoughts maybe with my siblings and maybe some friends, and realizing that nobody had the same thoughts about, I don't know, things like nature. I'd question things about nature, like the natural world. I'd question things like, I thought there was a meteorite coming to hit the planet every night because I'd researched so much about space, and I was like, well, surely like the probability is just, you know, it's going to happen one day. We're just floating around space, like something's going to hit us. And I think about that every night, and it would stop me from sleeping. So I was like quite an anxious kid, and then and I realized my siblings, you know, just slept soundly, and I didn't. And my love for music and singing, I assumed everybody could sing. I assumed everybody loved music the way that I did and listened to it in the same way that I did and picked out parts of the song like I did. So I found myself kind of, I did have a lot of friends, but I did find myself kind of alone in my thoughts and in my way of thinking and just became quite sort of solitary. And I would spend most evenings like just teaching myself guitar. I was quite a shy kid. Yeah.
How did the singing start? I mean, you're a mom of a kid, and you've probably seen a version of this either with your kid or others, which is you'll be in a playgroup with a bunch of kids, and there's clearly a kid in that group who is dancing and singing and just is up there going for it, you know? And were you that kid? Was that who you were? Were you just always singing?
I actually wasn't. Like I said, I was kind of a shy kid.
Yeah.
I was never really the one that was singing and dancing around the class, but I was always the one that wanted to. In my head, I was like, this is, you know, I should be singing. I should be dancing. And I remember I was so shy that I auditioned once for a part in a play to be in the chorus. I really just wanted to be part of the play, but I was far too shy to even consider being one of the main parts. And a couple of days later, I got a phone call and they said, we'd actually like you to play the main character. It was Dick Whittington, actually. God, so English.
That's a panto show, right? Isn't it the British panto, Christmas?
Yeah. Panto was very, it was a real thing at the time. And that was not what I ever could have imagined, that I would be a main character. I assumed, you know, I could be in the chorus, maybe. And so I had something, but I think that my acting I had to slightly put the acting aside because of that, because I just couldn't get the confidence for it. And then the singing was really how I managed to steer that confidence into something. I wanted to express myself and my thoughts, and I didn't know how to do it. So it just, that's kind of, I don't remember the second that I really started writing and singing, but I think it was around 8 or 9.
Did you remember as a kid, eight or nine, because you know, imagine you're singing a lot in your bedroom, probably, right? I mean, do you remember your mom, for example, saying to you, or people saying to you, like, you have a really special voice, like there's something different about you?
I don't really remember that. I don't remember anyone saying I had a special voice. I remember, like, again, going back to the shy thing. I shared my bedroom with two sisters, so it was in a tiny room, so. It was the three of us, and I would get again, like, self-conscious and wouldn't want to sing out loud. And that's when like I would escape. out to the fields, and I would walk and I would sing, and it was my place that I could go and sing as loud and shout as loud as I wanted to. I vaguely remember my mum making kind of comments, you know, being like, that bit's out of tune, or that bit's not quite right. But I think that was her way of like trying to push me. Maybe she knew that I had something, but, you know, didn't want to push it too much. But really, no, I felt like I was kind of on my own with it. And my dad wasn't around, obviously.
Yeah.
I do remember a moment where I sang to my uncle, who sadly passed away recently. But I remember he was a guitarist, and he wasn't related to me, but I called him my uncle because I lived with him and my aunt when I moved out of my home around 16. And I remember singing to him for the first time. And I do remember like him just being completely silent and not really knowing what to say. I do remember that. And he kind of walked out the room. And I think he said to my mom, who was in the kitchen, maybe, you know, she's got something.
Wow.
And was like, went really serious. So he kind of knew, you know, he was musical. He'd never heard me sing. He kind of taught me bits of guitar. And then to hear me sing for the first time, you know, he was, I think he was quite shocked.
Who would you listen to by the time you're a teenager? You know, when we're teenagers, that's when our sort of music tastes start to become a bit more sophisticated, and or not necessarily, but it's when we really start to listen to musicians who will become influential. Who do you remember really listening to?
I grew up listening to a lot of what my mom listened to, and my uncle lived with us for a while. They loved dance and pop music, and they'd listen to kind of mixtapes, bit of kind of rave and trance music, which was very kind of big at the time.
Yeah.
And so I grew up listening to that kind of euphoric, you know, escapist, Ibiza music, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got really into classical music from a young age. So around like 9 or 10, I discovered classical music through a CD that somebody gave me. And I rinsed that CD. I played it so many times, and it was just like it was literally just like a classical chill out CD. But it had like, oh my gosh, it had like, you know, some of the most iconic songs. And one that I can remember right now is, remember the song that was in Shawshank Redemption, and then the music that he plays when he locks himself in the office. And then it had like Michael Nyman, you know, the theme from The Piano.
Yeah.
He had something from Braveheart. Had like Craig Armstrong, Weatherstorm on there, and some like really iconic pieces, and I was obsessed with it. So I got myself into an orchestra playing clarinet. So clarinet was kind of my thing for a while.
Yeah.
But then I, for whatever reason, I discovered, I kind of went through like a grunge phase. Mm-hmm. Like pierced my lip when I was 14.
Uh-huh.
And it was like I was a Pearl Jam girl. I was an Incubus girl. I got quite into kind of new metal at one point.
Uh-huh.
I was a like religious Kerrang reader, Kerrang and Enemy. And then, you know, I went to Reading 2003, which really just summed me up at the time. Finished my GCSEs, went straight to Reading Festival, front row. It was like Sum 41, System of a Down, Metallica.
Oh, wow.
That was like me then. And then, you know, when that phase kind of started like ending, I then got into the greats. Like I discovered Björk for the first time when she was performing at the Albert Hall on TV. I discovered Joni Mitchell. I discovered Feist. I discovered Imogen Heap.
Beautiful, yeah.
So I suddenly, female voices, you know, Tori Amos, voices that weren't necessarily in the mainstream, like voices that weren't being played on the radio all the time. But it was just a whole new world, because I just grew up listening. You know, I lived in the countryside, lived in the middle of nowhere. So, so you know, like radio was like the place I discovered my music. And then suddenly I just went on this whole other journey with female singers.
You went to, you were, from everything I've read, a pretty good student in school. And you went to university to study whatever it was going to be that you were going to study, to do whatever it was you were going to do. But did you think already when you got to university, when you were 18, that you were going to pursue a career in music?
Well, I didn't think realistically that I could ever make it in music. It was drummed into me that it just wouldn't happen, by friends, by family, you know, really. And actually at the time, why would it? I was just, I didn't think I was anything special. I didn't think I had anything special. It was only really when I got to university that I started, when I started playing my songs to people, you know, I'd sort of go around to one of the student houses or student halls or whatever, play some songs, and it felt like I was being heard for the first time, really. You know, it's people from around the world in one place. I'd never experienced that before.
You were at the University of Kent.
I've never really met... University of Kent, yeah. And yeah, it's a very like multicultural, like welcoming place. And so there are people from, you know, I met all kinds of people, and it was like they heard me in a different way to how I'd been heard before. And I started to feel like maybe I did have something.
Yeah.
And I took my guitar. I mean, I remember buying like, I think it was like £200, but I had a £200 overdraft on my account. So I bought it with that, and then I like had no money. But it's funny, you know, I say that, like, why would it happen to me? I'm like just from a small town. But then you meet so many other people in this industry that had exactly the same thing and were just different, and they had something. And so it's not uncommon, you know. But I had like what they call a gap year, but it was never really a gap year. I didn't go on holiday. I didn't go to like Thailand. I stayed at home. I did an AS level, which is like the thing you do before an A level. I'm not sure what the equivalent is for you guys, but in film. So I then wanted to like study music and film. And then I worked at a pub, I worked at the theater, and I worked in a clothes shop. So I was just like making money, you know?
Yeah. How did you become comfortable pulling out your guitar and singing in front of other people? Was that hard for you at the beginning?
I think maybe I thought like, this is what I've got to offer. I was a shy person. I felt like everybody had these big personalities, and they had a good sense of humor, and they had a lot to offer in conversation and discussion. And I wasn't sure if I had much to bring to the table. I don't know why. I was just, I was just really too shy. And so I knew that was something that I had, you know. I do become a different person when I sing. That's what people tell me when they come see me perform. It's like I turn into a completely different character. And it's my kind of safe place. Mm. I have really bad anxiety, and it's something I deal with every day.
Yeah.
And I have since I was a kid. I just didn't know what it was. I couldn't name it at the time. And so any time I would sing, it sounds kind of like a cliche, but, you know, I could really escape into it and not really care what people were thinking about me. It became quite addictive, you know, to sing to people and feel that free and that calm and safe.
Tell me about writing songs. Were you writing song lyrics already as a teenager in your bedroom?
I was a lot. I fell madly, madly, deeply in love with somebody when I was 15, and maybe even somebody before that too. And it just got more and more intense. And God, we had this thing, MSN Messenger. I don't know what your equivalent was of that.
Yep.
Where we just sit and wait for somebody to come online. And, you know, and then you had to wait 5 minutes for the dial-up thing, the connection.
Right.
And,
right.
And you know, we weren't really allowed on the internet because it was expensive. And so I would, you know, my mum would drive to the shop, and then I'd quickly go online and wait for this guy to come online. God, what a waste of time. But but you know, when he didn't, or he said something, you know, or he was cold with me, my God, that was it. I would go upstairs and write a song. I'd write down lyrics in my diary, and it just was all consuming. I would fall in love so hard, and it just consumed me. You know, how did they feel about me? Were they thinking about me? When was I going to see them? Why didn't they like me? What was wrong with me? And and this would all be written down and stored up. Mm. Ready for my first album. And a lot of that stuff ended up on my first album.
It's amazing because you went to university with the intention of finishing. You did 3 years there. And help me understand how you went from thinking that this kind of future or this career wasn't something you would be able to do because it was out of reach, to actually going and starting to like pursue this career. What happened?
You know, I think maybe something in my mind changed. I think maybe it was just my attitude towards it changed more than the actual circumstances, because if I think about it, you know, the steps I took so often lead to failure. Like, just moving to London with no money, staying in somebody's flat in just one room and trying not to disturb whoever the hell else was living in the flat. I took a few books with me, took my guitar with me, and I had nothing. I really had nothing. So actually, when I think about it now, I'm like, that was a real risk that I took.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because quitting university, first person in my family to go to university by far, and then to just like drop all that, you know, it seemed very risky. And I didn't have any prospects. I didn't have anyone interested in me. I had, you know, a bit of applause at some open mic nights, but nothing that was really solid.
Yeah.
And then I think, you know, maybe I was pushing it in my head a bit more. Maybe I was manifesting it a bit more. And people started to turn up, like people from record labels started to turn up a bit more, people from publishers. And something seemed to just come together. Like, I don't know, frequencies were just like aligning or something. Because there was one night where like a record label and a publisher were interested in me at the same time. Like maybe there was just, I got to a point of exhaustion that was kind of working in my favor. Because, you know, I was trying so hard for like a year doing open mic nights. And then I think I'd kind of started to give up slightly, accepted that nothing was happening. Like a whole year had gone by and nobody was interested in me. And so maybe it was just that point of exhaustion and stopped giving a shit, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and maybe that was the turning point. And then it seemed to work.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, the very first song Ellie releases blows up, big time, leaving no chance to prepare for what her life would soon become. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to The Great Creators.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
Hey, welcome back to The Great Creators. Here's more of my conversation with Ellie Goulding. You released your first album in 2010, I believe. The single, Under the Sheets, comes out in 2009. Did you, before that happened, were you prepared in any way for what was about to happen to your life? I mean, going from living in a bedroom in this flat with a bunch of other people, broke, you know, obscure, unknown, to what was about to happen. Like, was there any part of you that was prepared for that?
I pretended to myself that I was prepared for it. When it started happening, I let it kind of happen to me. I didn't really put any boundaries on it. Didn't at any point stop to say, I don't know, this is weird. There's a photographer outside my house, or no, I can't go on live television. I don't know how to do live television. I've never been on television. Never sang into that kind of microphone before. I've never sang with this band. You know, it was all new. But me, kind of just my, I don't know, the way that I deal with things sometimes, which I now know is the wrong way to deal with things, is kind of pushing through, normalizing it, and it just becoming my life. Mm. And because I did that, it resulted in me being on a train one day, going back to a friend's dad's funeral back in Hereford, and I kind of passed out, had a panic attack. I went to hospital. This woman told me to blow into a paper bag. There was a pain down my entire left arm. Mm. And my heart was pounding and I was dripping with sweat. And I really thought, this is it. I was going to be gone. And I suppose that was all the stored up stuff that had been happening to me, going on tit television, suddenly everyone knowing my name, being photographed every day, being told what I looked like, what I should be wearing, what I should look like. It was obviously too much and something I was not prepared for.
Yeah.
And I then had to, you know, try and cope with it all with cognitive behavioral therapy and covering my face anytime I went to the studio in the car because things would trigger me. Everything would trigger me. So I have a visual of going to the studio with a cushion over my face so that I couldn't see anything in the street. It's just, when I think about it, God, it was a lot. Yeah.
I mean, you were so young and all of a sudden sort of catapulted into this world where your song, your first single was a hit and then it was just like this, you know, rocket ship. I mean, I think just recently with your latest song, Miracle, you're now the most charted songs in UK history. I think you just beat out Dame Shirley Bassey, which is pretty amazing. But I mean, before that happened, right, you were sort of catapulted into the spotlight. And I know you've talked about this a little bit, but tell me a little bit about what that meant. I mean, was sort of the decision-making out of your hands, you know, on what to sing, what to say, what to wear, your image, all those things?
I think back then, when it came to strictly the music, I had a good hold on things. I had a good instinct. And I worked with the same person at my record label, Ferdy, and he trusted me. He trusted my instincts on what should the next single should be, and I trusted his. And it worked. We had a thing. That's why it's so important when you meet that person you work with that you have a kind of connection. And it just, for whatever reason, was working. But then there were other things that I felt were out of my hands. What I was wearing, what kind of artist they wanted me to be. You know, it did feel slightly like, we don't have this kind of artist.
Yeah.
Maybe this is what she could be, you know? And because I didn't have that much confidence in the way I looked, didn't think I was pretty, didn't think I had a good body, all the things that at the time, it's so much better now, God. But at the time, you know, were really important for like a female artist. You had to be pretty and aesthetically pleasing and perfect, and you had to wear clothes that, you know, you had to either be girl next door or you had to be like super sexy. I wasn't really any of those things. You know, I was a runner. I ran every day. I did lifted weights every day. I didn't fit into any of those categories really. And so I think they were maybe a bit confused as to what to do with me. And the music was really telling the whole story. The music was really my whole identity. And it was quite pure. And I didn't really feel like I needed to do much else. But then I do think that because of this kind of identity crisis, it did make me rely on them to make decisions for me, which I slightly regret. I have so much more of a control over it now. I work with a creative director and I have the right people around me to help me say no as well and help me have the boundaries and help me have confidence in myself and to trust my own intuition with things. But back then, yeah, I was young, I was naive, and I did listen to what other people said over my own opinion a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I admit.
Tell me how I'm sure it's evolved over time, you know, from you know, writing your earlier songs to obviously to a song like Lights to, you know, the work you know on your new album, but sort of help me kind of unpack your creative process in how you approach a song. So let's take, I mean, we can take any of your songs and there's a great video that people should see. You did a video for Pitchfork where you talk about how you use your voice as an instrument and it's really cool. But I'm curious about how you think about a song because you've had 35 of your songs have charted in the UK. It's just unbelievable. And I'm sure that there are people and producers, some of whom you've worked with, you know, Diplo and Calvin Harris and others, who probably try to deconstruct what is it about an Ellie Goulding song that just you know, catches fire. Let's talk about how you think about a song, first of all. Like, you know, any song, you pick a song on the new album. Like, when you sit down and think, this is what I want it to do or sound like or be, where do you start?
It's funny, at one point, I had about 10 songs in circulation in my head that I'd think of when I was making all music. There was, you know, there was like a Bon Iver song in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. There was like a Taylor Swift song in there somewhere. There was a Francis and the Lights song in there at one point, an Imogen Heap song, a Kanye West song even. I don't even know if I'm allowed to say that now, but...
nobody is.
No, exactly. You know, even maybe even like an artist like Burial in the very beginning, and then there'd be like a band like The Knife, or like Jose Gonzalez, all these different things that were just like always circling around my brain. And so genuinely, I go into the studio, and I think that's normal. You know, I had these influences, and I was like, I want to sound a bit like this, I want to sound a bit like this, I want to sound a bit like this, a bit like this. And then, you know, anyone I'd work with would be like, what? You know, and we can't sound like all those things. But it was possible, it turns out. And when I first started writing songs on my guitar, everyone assumed I was like a folk singer because it was just me and guitar. I would finger pick in this way that was very folky, inspired, influenced. Mm-hmm. But it was just the way that I played. Most people play with all their fingers, and I would just play with two fingers and play very fast. And then I would pluck two strings kind of at a time, and it would create this kind of like a song called Wish I Stayed. It would go ding, 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 ding. And so everyone naturally was like, oh, wow, this is this kind of folk singer. Because my voice, you know, I was influenced by everything from Bjork to even, you know, Destiny's Child to like Dolly Parton. Fleetwood Mac, now they're all coming out, ABBA. But actually, my passion was electronic music. I grew up, it was just in my blood. And so the first person I reached out to on MySpace, which every producer, every electronic producer will know and worship, who is Burial. And I reached out to him and I said, I really want to work with you. And we did end up meeting up. I think I gave him some of my vocals. His thing is sampling lots of different vocals. Yeah. He sampled like Christina Aguilera and Mariah Carey. And then I kind of never saw him again. And then I reached out to, there was a producer at the time called Frank Music. I reached out to, this was in the very, very beginning. This was like pre-record deal even.
Right.
But then I knew when I made my, I knew, you know what it was? And then I reached out to Starsmith. I'd heard a Starsmith track on MySpace. Mm-hmm. And I sent him a couple of acoustic demos, and then he sent something back. And I remember it was a demo for Starry Eyed. And it was just this, it was really fast, like as fast as Miracle, the song I have with Calvin at the moment.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's it. That is it. That is my sound.
Yeah.
And I mean, it sounds too easy, you know, that you just send an acoustic song to a producer and they write back going, what about this? But then, you know, why did I reach out to him in particular? You know, why did he get back to me? There was all, you know, there's all these like serendipitous things, and it was just there. And Under the Sheets and Starry were my first two songs, and it just, people were saying, we've never heard anything like this before. Mm. And that was it. I mean, it sounds too simple to be true, but it's just, you know, sometimes that's how it is.
How do you, when you're collaborating with somebody, because obviously you're collaborating with lots of people, and let's take the song Burn, for example, because we just had Ryan Tedder on the show a couple weeks ago, and he's obviously an incredibly gifted songwriter and then artist and musician in his own right.
And just also just a beautiful
just
human
a
being
a lovely
as well.
Person, yeah.
We are lucky to have Ryan, yeah.
So when you're writing a song like Burn, I mean, how do you, or you know, when you're collaborating with somebody on a song, right? How do you do it? I mean, how does it work? Are you, you know, sort of exchanging ideas for the words and the sound together? And how do you sort of know what's going to work?
Well, with Burn, I have to say that it was a fully formed idea. So I'm just going to like say that uh-huh. he had the song. And this is Ryan just being the genius that he is. He knows how to write a hit record. And it's a real skill and an art form. So he would have gone through, I cannot take credit for it, because he clearly has such a process, and I've seen him work. We did a lot of work together on my third album, Delirium, and we've written together at other times too. And the way his brain works is just, I'm just like watching him like running back and forth across the room. Like, then he'll sit down at the piano, and then he'll pick up the guitar, and then he's like, what about this bit? What about that bit? And then we can have that there. And I'm like, what? You know, it just blows my mind.
Yeah.
And it's such a joy to work, you know, to work with such a mind when it comes to pop, because he knows exactly what people want to hear at what point in the song. And it's just a gift. And so Burn was a fully formed idea when I came along. I think that it had even been sung by other singers. But then there was something about, I remember we recorded it in Vegas, it's so random. And I was on tour with Bruno Mars at the time, I believe. And I think I just recorded it, and it was kind of blowing up in the UK, but not really in America, actually.
Yeah.
It was number one, it went to number one in the UK. And I mean, that was a shock. I didn't expect that at all. But when I recorded it, it's so funny because the song was so strong, and it was like, and we're gonna let it burn. And then I come along and I, you know, sound like, and we're gonna let it burn, burn, burn. It just, for whatever reason, it worked. But, you know, not before it went to Greg Kurstin, one of my favorite producers in the world. I think that may have been my suggestion. I can't remember. Again, maybe it was Ryan, his genius. But that's how the song ended up, the final version. And so I know that's not the greatest example of collaboration and creativity, because when you collaborate with someone from the very beginning, it's very different. You're shy. You're not sure if people are going to like each other's ideas. You sometimes need to down a couple of drinks just to feel like you can dare to say something dumb or play a dodgy chord. And you know, as a woman as well, like, it's often a woman going into a room with a bunch of men, who are pretty self-assured and sort of know how they want things to sound. And so you have to be like a bit more assertive. You have to have, have a bit of Dutch courage and just trust in yourself. It's the hardest thing ever, but to really go in and to, even if you have to fake it, if you're not feeling particularly trusting or like of your instincts that day, you just got to. And honestly, some of my best songs have come from trusting myself despite having doubts and despite thinking, I don't know if this is good or not, but I'm just going to go with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and some of my best songs have come from that, from me faking confidence.
We're going to take a really short break, but when we come back, Ellie tells us how she's trying to make pop music fun again by writing songs that are less about herself and more about other people. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to The Great Creators.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey, welcome back to The Great Creators. Here's more from my chat with Ellie Goulding. I wonder, when you think about this idea that you've had so many songs that have just resonated, right? Not just resonated, but that have charted. There are thousands and thousands of successful, maybe not thousands, but hundreds of successful artists who have had maybe 5 songs chart, and they're incredibly successful artists, but to have 35 is different. And I wonder, when you work on a song, whether on your own or in collaboration, when you write it with somebody, when it's written for you, there is still part of that process is knowing to some extent whether that song is going to work. Is it knowable? Mm. Do you, when you're recording a song, do you know this is going to be a hit?
You used to be able to. I felt like you could be pretty certain about a song. And I remember Ferdy Unger Hamilton, who doesn't work at Polydor anymore, but I remember him going, yeah, you know what, Els, he used to call me Els, and he'll love, because everyone does impressions of him because he speaks like this. You know what, Els, like, this song's a hit, all right, so we're going to, you know, I think we should go with this one, and, you know, it'll do really well, and it'll probably chart really well, and then we'll do this and do that, and I'm like, okay. And he just knew, you know, he was so good at that. And he was one of the old school A&R people that just, you know, he was infamous. He was like, everyone knew him. He was written about even, and like in books. And he was just kind of like the old school A&R guy. And I really hope he never hears this. He probably will. But it did. He was right. He was always right. And then it gets to this point where, you know, people are digesting music in such a broader way now. It could be a hit now, can be a song that you've written, that you've released 5 years ago, that has been sped up, put on TikTok, mixed with someone who's created a dance out of nowhere, or a scenario.
Yeah.
And it is a combination of those things that for some reason appeals to people in a very specific way, but still reaches out, you know, on a broader scale. It's not like it just appeals to one or two people. It is like, you know, the video of the man skateboarding with the Dyrolite or whatever it was.
Right.
A Pedialyte, or right. I can't remember. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
And Singing Dreams, right?
Dreams by Fleetwood Mac. And then, you know, the moment in Stranger Things, you know, where Kate Bush is singing Running Up the Hill. So there are these just like kind of cultural reset moments where, for some reason, there are a combination of things in a very short space of time that are making people listen to music in a different way and making young people discover old songs that they would never have otherwise heard, really. You know, they wouldn't necessarily have even paid attention to Dreams if it had just come on the radio where they were driving in the car with their parents or with their friends or whatever. So it's just, it's interesting now that no, you can't tell. And it's so unpredictable. Like a song from my second album is doing the rounds on TikTok at the moment. It's called My Blood. Like, where? How did that happen? You know, you just can't tell.
I wonder for your new record, for Higher Than Heaven, when you're writing songs or recording them, do you think about that? I mean, given that, you know, radio is not, it's not the same anymore. I mean, it's still influential, and in the UK for sure, you know, more than in the US, let's say, right? But if radio is not as influential, right, and let's say TikTok or social media is, how does it change how you write a song?
I'm not going to, like, pretend that I don't pay any attention to that stuff. I think it's crazy for someone to be like, I just write songs and, you know... And I think that's a beautiful thing for anyone to ignore the noise and anyone to ignore the pressures of TikTok and of social media and am I going to be played on radio? Like here it's, you know, I guess radio is, it maybe doesn't mean as much. I don't know. Because, you know, so many people are streaming music now and finding songs on, I discover a lot of music on TikTok now.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it's still, you know, back in the day for me to be played on Radio 1 was like my biggest achievement.
Yeah.
All I wanted to do was be played on Radio 1. I loved every DJ. I would wait for every live lounge to happen. And, you know, the fact that I suddenly was being supported by Radio 1, by, you know, Zane Lowe and Greg James and Annie Mack and, you know, these amazing radio DJs was just like a dream. And, you know, I haven't had my songs played on Radio 1 for a while, I don't think. The Calvin song is being played on Radio 1, but like, you know, I notice things like that. I notice when my music isn't being played. Radio 2 play my songs all the time and they have embraced my new music. And it's like, I don't know, it goes through phases. Mm. Like, I feel like I don't, that must mean that I don't know what I'm thinking about when I make the songs, because I'm not making them for anyone in particular.
Yeah.
But obviously I know how to make a pop record. I just don't know where it's going to end up now. There are so many new people embracing the music, and then maybe some people are not embracing it as much anymore. I don't know. Of course those things are in the back of my mind, because it's impossible to not think about, well, where are these songs going to be played? Like, are they going to see the light of day? And actually I'm kind of at peace with it, because I make so many songs and I have so many songs that haven't been played and haven't been heard. I just got those songs, just, you know, I'm glad I made them. I listen to them, sometimes enjoy them. And maybe at some point, like 10 years time, one of those songs will crop up on TikTok and become a massive smash.
Yeah.
I mean, you just never know. So it's so unpredictable, but it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah. Tell me about your sort of work process, right? I mean, you've got, obviously, your mom, you've got a two-year-old, so that's I've been there. It's a lot. But do you have a particular discipline, like you sit down every day for a certain period of time and you write, or you mess around on your keyboard, or do you carry a notebook and when inspiration or an idea strikes you, you write it down? Like, how do you write a record? Is it just sort of happen over time, or do you set aside a very specific amount of time to make it happen?
At the moment, you're right to mention like becoming a mum, because that takes up all your time, and it's because all I want to do is be with him.
Yeah,
and that means I'm not. I couldn't just sit there and be writing a song when he's in the background, because I just want to be seeing what he's doing, and just like playing with him and, you know, hanging out. So that's just like now. Yes, I write a lot less. But then I realized that my writing comes in kind of phases, because sometimes I will sit and just like things will just flow. And it's usually because I've been through something or my anxiety has been particularly bad and I really just need to get things off my chest. I realized how much I relied on writing things down to get them out of my head. Now more than ever with this anxiety stuff. But back in the day, you know, it was something that was just my life. It was every day was guitar, it was singing, it was playing, it was writing, and I was addicted to being in the studio. You know, I just wanted to go and get in the studio with people. I wanted to make songs. I imagine Ryan Tedder would say something similar, because, you know, when you're a songwriter, it's just all you want to do. And then, you know, now I do have to be more kind of picky and more selective with my time. And so I keep trying to get in the studio, but when you're in like a promotion run, like now, it's hard to switch between doing like interview after interview and then going and sitting in the studio and trying to write songs. It just, for some reason, just doesn't quite work.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure you've heard before.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, my dream is to go away, you know, maybe somewhere like to Ireland or to Norway, somewhere remote, and sit and write with people and just have time. You know, there's always like a time limit. I said recently, this album is the least personal album I've made. Mm. It wasn't ironic, you know, it's true. It doesn't mean that it's not a great album, but the next album, I do feel like it's going to be something different. I can't quite put my finger on it yet, but I've been having some weird thoughts and I've been writing them down, as so I feel like something is like brewing.
You say that this album is not a personal record, which I think is interesting, because it's almost like you're like a fiction writer. You're writing about experiences that may not be your own, and this is what novelists do all the time. So where do you get ideas for writing an album that's not personal? Because when it's personal, you know, it's like your own experiences or heartbreak or tragedy or trauma or love or whatever it might be. And those, I'm sure, are reflected in so much of your work. And this record is not necessarily about Ellie Goulding. It's about just experiences. So where do you get the ideas for those songs and how to perform them?
Well, I read books. I read fiction. Mm-hmm. I read articles. I read stories about other people.
Yeah.
I listen to my friends. I try and listen much more than I talk at them. And I don't want to talk about, you know, work and what I do. I just want to hear about other people. So that's really important. Yeah. I hear other people's stories. And then even in the studio, you know, they always say, like, what, you know, they're interested in what I've been up to and what I've been going through. And I just want to know what they've been doing.
Yeah.
And so there's that. And then I don't know. I just, when I hear music, it will just kind of start to build a story in my head, like a kind of script. And I just start thinking of the video. And I start thinking of who are the characters. You know, maybe there's this person that needs to be saved, you know, in like a savior, or like by the end of the night, maybe there's this person that's just so in love. They're just spouting all this kind of sycophantic language off. And, mm-hmm. you know, so it sometimes just starts with the music and then I start making up a story and, you know, voila. And then it just happens. And, you know, then I start perfecting the lyrics a bit more into a pop song. But that's really how it starts. And when it comes to my own things, I have to write and write and write and then bring it back. Which was kind of what I did on Brightest Blue.
Yeah. But
Brightest Blue was very much my own, all from personal experience. So it was really refreshing to write something that wasn't remotely.
Yeah. What is the story or the stories you're telling on this record?
Story of love. Story of infatuation. Mm-hmm. You know, dancing into another world. all these things, you know, that I think people need right now.
Yeah.
Bit of escapism, bit of a fictional pop record. I really thought that comment would backfire, you know, about it not being personal, but everyone's loving it. I read an article yesterday that was like, thank God that Ellie Goulding's like making pop fun again, you mm-hmm. know, and maybe I am. I like that. I'll take that. But I still see myself as doing like a very... I don't compare myself with anyone, like in the most sort of, you know, in the healthiest way. I just, you know, I don't collaborate with that many people. I do collaborate with people, but like I still work with like a small group of people.
Yeah.
And I don't see myself as having like competition or having similar things going on around me. I don't know. I just do my own thing. And so I feel like I can get away with it a bit, you know?
I mean, being a parent, being a mom, and, you know, and now, you know, you had this sort of like 10-year period of just nonstop touring and recording and touring and recording. And then I think a lot of that was sort of slowed down by COVID for you and for everybody, really. And so you've come out of that. We've come out of that period. And how do you think about, you know, sort of phase two of your career now? I mean, you are... You know, you've achieved all these incredible things and have made all these huge hits. And now you are entering the second phase of your career, which you will have a lot more control over and you will decide, you know, how you want to structure it. And what does that mean for you?
Well, I never take for granted that I'm at a point where I can work with, you know, the best songwriters and producers in the world.
Yeah.
And they'll always take a chance with me. They'll always want to get in the room with my voice at the very least, even though they don't like, you know, if they're not into my music or into my lyrics, you know, they'll definitely be into my voice. So I've got that. And then I think my symbolic thing, you know, is dyeing my hair back to my natural color. And like my fans always comment on it, you know, because they think it's great. They think it's, you know, like empowering and it's maybe sort of like the first sign of me just, you know, taking it back and really feeling like I'm in a good place to keep exploring what I do as a writer, as a pop singer. That is my favorite thing to do. You know, I've always wanted to write classical songs for films. I've always wanted to compose music for films. I've always wanted to make an electronic record and then like a folk record. So all these things, but it always comes back to pop because I'm so addicted to the feeling that I get when people, you know, lots of people are listening to my music. It's just very addictive. And I don't know if I see it as like another phase, but I feel truly lucky to still be doing exactly what I want to do. And I don't feel particularly restricted in any way. And maybe that's a privilege. Maybe there are people out there that feel more restricted than I do at this point, but I don't feel like I've changed much since if I walked into the room with somebody that I worked with 10 years ago, I don't know if they'd notice that much change in me other than I'm more, you know, silently confident about what I'm doing. I think that makes a huge difference.
Mm.
When I'm working with people, that I like to think that I've grown as a human. I feel like I'm also still like that, the girl that I was walking to a studio when I was, you know, 20 years old, you know.
Yeah.
Still curious, still open-minded, still wanting to just have fun and laugh with people, still wanting to know about other people's lives. And I think that's probably the thing that has kept me here this long.
Ellie Goulding, thank you so much.
Thank you. God, I'm so thrilled that we talk so much about music. That's just my dream. You know, because I sometimes do chat, you know, I haven't done many podcasts really at all. But, you know, it'll be like, you know, not about music, you know.
Right.
But I love talking about music. It's what I do and I live and breathe it, you know. And so thank you. I really appreciate that.
That's Ellie Goulding. Her new album, Higher Than Heaven, is out now. You can find a link to stream the album at our website at thegreatcreators.com/Goulding. We've also put a link to the music video for Ellie's first single, Under the Sheets. And you can find all of our previous episodes at thegreatcreators.com. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Great Creators early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Hey, thanks so much for listening to our show this week. Please be sure to click the follow button on your podcast app so you don't miss any new episodes. It's free and it takes just a second. This episode was produced by Nat Hoops and edited by Jeff Rogers. Thanks also to Kevin Leahy, Michael May, Elaine Coates, Kayla Rosenbaum, Jenna Gedman, and Daniel Shukin. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to The Great Creators from Built It Productions.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.